Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. Website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format. Got a great show for you today. In the second hour, I'm going to be talking with David Enders, live from Iraq. He's a 24-year-old independent reporter over there. Just wrote a great article about Fallujah for Mother Jones. And also, I'll be talking with Monica Benderman, whose husband, Kevin, was just sentenced to 15 months in the brig for refusing to be redeployed to Iraq. That's in the second hour, but first we're going to talk to Walter Block. He's a professor and chair of economics at Loyola University in New Orleans. He writes for My Precious, LouRockwell.com, Mises.org, the Journal of Libertarian Studies, the Review of Austrian Economics, the Journal of Labor Economics, Cultural Dynamics, and the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. He is the author, editor, and co-editor of many books, including Defending the Undefendable, Lexicon of Economic Thought, Economic Freedom of the World, 1975 through 1995, Rent Control, Myths and Realities, Discrimination, Affirmative Action, and Equal Opportunity, Theology, Third World Development, and Economic Justice, Man, Economy, and Liberty, Essays in Honor of Murray N. Rothbard, Religion, Economics, and Social Thought, and Economic Freedom, Toward a Theory of Measurement. Wow. Welcome to the show, Mr. Block.
It's my pleasure to be here with you.
That sure is an impressive resume you got there.
You're very kind. Thank you.
All right. So starting tomorrow, if I'm correct, is Mises University. What's Mises University?
Well, I guess before you get to Mises University, you have to get to Mises Institute.
Yeah, what's the Mises Institute, and then what's the Mises University?
Well, the Mises Institute is founded and presided over by Lou Rockwell, and it resides in Auburn, Alabama, right across the street from Auburn University, and it is an economic public policy libertarian think tank, which is predicated on Austrian economics and mainly the economics and politics of Ludwig von Mises, who was a very famous economist and a free enterpriser. The Mises Institute has several journals, including the Journal of Libertarian Studies and the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics and the Mises Review. It publishes books. It gives conferences. It supports students who are of a free enterprise or orientation. And it also, one of its programs is it puts on Mises University. Now, Mises University is a one-week, very intensive series of classes. There are about 10 or 11 professors, of whom I am one, and there'll be about 120 or 130 students starting this Sunday. And there are numerous courses on economics, philosophy, history, public policy, libertarianism, and Austrian economics mainly.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, it's a blast.
I wish I could be there for that.
Well, you're missing out.
I've actually had friends who have gone and spent the week at Mises University before and said it was just a blast.
Yes, it's really an eye-opener for people, and there are students that have come several years, 20 years ago, and have had their eyes open to the freedom philosophy.
Okay, well, you know, I get strange looks sometimes when I mention Austrian economics because people think, Austria? What model of economics has Austria ever come up with?
Right. Well, you know, there is such a thing called Chicago economics, and it's got nothing to do with Chicago. It just so happens that the main creators of it, I guess Milton Friedman and George Stigler and Gary Becker, all were associated with the University of Chicago. Similarly, there's nothing Austrian about Austrian economics. It just so happens that Menger, Bombeverk, and Mises and Hayek, the main creators and first founders of it, all came from Austria. So it's just a shorthand form for the certain kind of economics that stems from Menger and Bombeverk and Mises.
Okay, and we'll get right back to what exactly is that kind of economics. Right after this break, we're talking with Walter Block from the Mises Institute on the Weekend Interview Show.
Watch it now.
friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Walter Block. And we're learning all about Austrian economics. You said before the break, sir, that Austrian economics is called that because the inventors of this sort of economic theory were from Austria, Hayek, Menger, and Mises. So what exactly was their style of economics, and how different is it from, I guess, regular neoclassical economics that are the common vogue today?
Well, if I were to offer a map of economic schools of thought, I would say on the left are the Marxists, and they believe that the labor theory of value is correct, and therefore labor creates all value, and the capitalist is in effect stealing from the worker. And I would say that very few economists now believe in this. Moving over toward the right from the left, we would then get to the Keynesian or left-wing economists who believe that there's a lot of market failure. They're not socialists, but they're semi-socialists. They would say favor socialized medicine or unions or minimum wage laws or all sorts of regulations, antitrust and regulations in the alphabet soup. FDA and all regulatory agencies in Washington. And this is sort of the economic school that is most associated with the Democratic Party. Moving a little further to the right, we then arrive at the Chicago School, which is one of the free enterprise schools of economics, the other being the Austrian School. And this is sort of the economics philosophy that would be most conversant or consistent with the Republican Party. Here, there are still some market failures, and we still have some justification for government regulation, but it's much less, fewer regulatory bodies, more private property, lower taxes, less government, but still quite a bit. Speaking as an Austrian, moving over to the extreme right now, we get into the area of laissez-faire capitalism, where private property rights and free enterprise and the profit motive are seen as unadulteratedly good, whereas the Chicago School, the moderate school of free enterprise, would say, well, they're good, but we have to have government fix up their errors and their flaws and their failures. And the laissez-faire school of Austrian economics says, no, 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 there are no market failures. Any market failures that you guys think are market failures really are government failures, government errors that create problems in the first place, and then are blamed on markets, for example. And here's something even the Chicago School would agree with. If there's a housing crisis, it's probably caused by rent control or government mismanagement, and it's not really a market problem. So that would be a sort of a quick tour of all four of the main schools of thought in economics. And under the Chicago School, the right-wing economics, I would certainly include public choice and rational expectations and the supply side and a few others. But the Austrian is unique from the closest to us, the other free enterprise school of thought. On the one hand, we, the Austrians, are very much more free enterprise than any of these others. And secondly, there are differences in methodology as well. So that would be a sort of a first stab at the waterfront of economics and the Austrian part of this waterfront.
Okay, so the two center, I guess, schools of economic thought on your map there are the Keynes and the Chicago School. And I guess this is basically what the average government school education turns out, is that sort of understanding of economics,
yes,
right?
I think that's pretty clear. I would say that if you were to put percentages on it, the Chicago and the Keynesian, between the two of them, have 90% of all economists. And we and the Marxists would share the rest of it.
Oh, really? Are the Austrians that small of a segment?
Yes, very much smaller than the Chicagoites. Just as a rough approximation, give the left-wing Keynesian 45% and the right-wing Chicagoites 45%, and give us and the Marxists 5%. I might be off by a little bit. This is just an informal impression that I have, but that would be the rough order.
Well, I'm kind of confused about the Chicago School. My reading of Keynes has it that supply-side and demand-side economics are both part of his socialist model, right? Like, he tended to prefer demand-side economics, but wasn't supply side just right Keynesianism?
Well, Milton Friedman has a very interesting quote that's in the Samuelson textbook. And the quote goes, Samuelson is quoting Milton Friedman as saying, "We're all Keynesians now." I once asked Milton about this, and he said, "Well, Samuelson got it right, but it was out of context." The full quote is, and now I'm giving you a paraphrase, "When it comes to public policy analysis," this is Milton Friedman speaking, "there is a world of difference between us and the Keynesians in terms of public policy recommendations. But when it comes to the tools of analysis, we're all Keynesians now."
Right.
Well, I would say that the tools of analysis are very much more important than the public policy recommendations, because the latter come from the former. So as far as I, as an Austrian, am concerned, you know, a pox on both houses. They both believe in that the economy is sort of like a car. And it's always either going too slow or too fast, and the government's got to put on the brakes or put on the gas. And it's always going to get off the road, so the government's got to steer it lest it go off into the ditch on one side or the other. Whereas the Austrian, in contradistinction to both of those two mainstream groups, say that no. The reason the car keeps speeding up and slowing down and hiving off into one ditch or the other is because of government mismanagement in the first place. And that if we had laissez-faire capitalism, the thing would run very, very smoothly and not need any driver. Adam Smith's invisible hand would work quite fine. Thank you.
Well, now here we're going to have to rewind the time machine a little bit, because I think the basic understanding that, I don't know, I guess I learned in junior high school of, for example, the Great Depression, was that, like you're saying, government coming to smooth out the excesses of the capitalism, the car's running off the road and it has to be corrected. So
yes.
you would then say that it was actually government that caused the Great Depression, not the excesses of free market capitalism?
Absolutely. And here, even Milton Friedman is pretty good, although he deviates from the Austrian view, which I think is more correct. You see, the Keynesian view says that the Great Depression comes about because of imperfections in the market that are deeply embowed or deeply embedded in the essence of the market. It just can't work well. It's subject to depressions. What Friedman says is, no, the Fed allowed the money supply in around 1930 to fall by about a third, and this sort of screwed up the whole thing, got us into deflation, and then the Smoot-Hawley tariff exacerbated things even more. Whereas the Austrians say, no, it's not really the Fed allowing the money supply to fall by a third, and even if it were, the Fed is a government enterprise, so how can you say that it's the market's fault when it's the Fed's fault? But the Austrians would go further and say that the real cause of the Depression of the 30s was the inflationary policy that the Fed, emphasis on the Fed being a government institution, created in the 20s and misallocated resources. And in the 20s and in the 30s, there was just a recession or a depression that would have corrected the mistakes of the 20s, but Roosevelt and Hoover before him, there was a Hoover New Deal as well, these exacerbated things, and also the Smoot-Hawley tariff further ruined the economy. You see, what they did, what Hoover and Roosevelt did, is they artificially bid up wages and kept encouraging businesses to keep wages high, and they kept encouraging unions. But when you have unemployment, the last thing you want to do is to artificially bid up wages. So the analysis of the Austrians is that the Hoover-Roosevelt New Deal made the Depression worse and prolonged it, and the cause of it was government mismanagement in the 20s in the first place.
Well, but, you know, they always say the New Deal, well, it almost saved us from the Great Depression, but World War II, now that really saved us from the Great Depression.
All right. Well, if you look at the, well-being of the consumer during World War II was even worse. It was a much bigger depression. So the Austrian analytic framework would say that World War II did not at all save us from the depression, but it was a continuation of the depression.
Well, you know, you conscript 14 million men, you're going to do good work for the unemployment rate, at least.
That's right. That's right. There was much less unemployment. But as Keynes said, you know, you don't have to have a war to do this. All you have to do is dig holes and fill them up again, and you can get rid of unemployment. But the point is that digging holes and filling them up again, or shooting off bombs as a way of not fighting the evil Nazis, we're not talking about that, but just conscripting people to, you know, shoot, doesn't help with the economy, because the economy is composed of, you know, air conditioners and clothing and food and movies and things like that. So in terms of those consumer goods, we were depressed right up until 45 or 46. And namely, it took us that long to get out of the Depression, which testifies to the mismanagement of government.
And if I remember right, wasn't there like massive inflation in the 50s and just more consequences that just kept rolling on down the hill?
Well, there was some inflation in the 50s, but that didn't eventuate into a depression. The main cause of the depression was the inflation of the 20s. And in the U.S., it was relatively mild compared to Germany, where they had a hyperinflation.
Right.
And that hyperinflation led to the rise of Hitler, which shows that economics can be very powerful.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Walter Block from the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Loyola University. We'll be right back. Everybody, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Walter Block from Loyola University and the Ludwig von Mises Institute, available at Mises.org. You mentioned before, sir, about how the Austrian School of Economics is against antitrust law. And this is the kind of thing where you can find people who are very, very anti-government and who will still say, well, but we still need some antitrust laws. And, you know, I learned when I was a kid, actually, my high school history teacher, great lady, but she's kind of a left-wing anarchist, and she taught us that the libertarians are the rich white man's anarchy, that they basically want a couple of rich elitist white men to be able to have total monopolies on everything and basically privatize the country and make it three little kingdoms, and that we have to have antitrust because in a natural state of affairs, capitalism tends toward monopoly, and so we need to use our elected representatives to break those monopolies up.
Scott, I'll talk about antitrust, but can I make a deal with you?
Sure.
What happened during the break is that there were three commercials.
Yeah.
The last one advertised your radio station. The middle one was something about some vitamin supplement.
Mm-hmm.
But the first one was an advertisement for gold. And after antitrust, could we talk about gold? Because that, too, distinguishes the two right-wing or the two free enterprise schools of thought.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So let's first do antitrust since you introduced it. But I've got to promise that we do gold as well.
Okay, no problem.
And I'm sure your advertiser will be happy that we're taking up from his advertisement and talking about the subject that he raised.
Well, let's hope so.
Okay, well, in terms of antitrust, if we take the four schools of thought and ask what do they all say about it, well, for the Marxists, you don't really need antitrust because there'd be no private business anyway. It'd all be government, and that's hunky-dory for them. So let's forget them for the moment.
Okay.
For the left-wing Keynesians, think the Democratic Party, your school teacher or your elementary school teacher or your high school teacher, she sounds like one of them, namely that the market is left to its own devices will end up with fewer and fewer people owning more and more things, and eventually Bill Gates and Walmart would own everything.
Right.
And we've got to stop that. In order to do that, we've got to have antitrust from here to there and make sure a business doesn't take one step without getting the permission of Hillary or something like that. The Chicago view is very much more nuanced and very interesting. They, too, say that there is such a thing as market failure, and one of the market failures is the tendency of monopoly to occur in the free enterprise system. And you do need antitrust. However, they take the very important step of saying that antitrust, the main problem with that is that it misallocates resources, and they try to find a deadweight loss measure of the seriousness of the misallocation of resources. However, then they very properly say, but an antitrust division of government also costs money. You have to have lawyers, you have to have court space, you have to have judges, you have to have economists. And therefore, the only time you should have antitrust is when the misallocation of monopoly is greater than the cost of stopping monopoly, which seems to be a very sensible way to go about it. Whereas the Austrians, I think, are much more correct and say that the whole thing is a crock, and there is no such thing as a market monopoly. There is no monopoly on the market. And let me introduce this to you with a joke that I once told a bunch of antitrust lawyers and economists. It's a two-part joke. In the first part, they were laughing uproariously. The second part, which I think is just as funny, they didn't say a word because they know which side of the bread there, which, you know, their butter is, and if we got rid of antitrust, a lot of these people would lose their jobs. A friend of mine once specialized in monetary economics, and he said there's no money in money economics. It's all the money is antitrust in terms of being an expert witness and such. So here are the two jokes. First joke, we're in the Soviet Union, and there are three prisoners in the gulag, and as prisoners do, they compare notes. And the first one says, I was in prison because I came to work late, and they accused me of cheating the state out of my labor. The second guy says, well, I came to work early, and they accused me of brown-nosing, so they put me in jail. The third guy said, I came to work every day exactly on time, and they accused me of owning a Westin wristwatch. And this one got a big laugh from the assembled economists and lawyers in antitrust. Then I told another joke, and deathly silence here. And I said, there were three prisoners in the U.S., and they were in jail for economic crimes, violating monopoly law. And the first guy says, I charged higher prices than anyone else, and they accused me of price gouging and profiteering. The second guy said, well, I charged lower prices than anyone else, and they accused me of predatory pricing and cutthroat competition. And the third guy said, I charged the same prices as everyone else, and they accused me of collusion and trying to set up
price fixing.
I'm sorry?
Price fixing.
Price fixing, right. And here, it's just as true, and it was deathly silence, because the point is that antitrust law and the whole monopoly theory of, you know, becoming a monopoly is dead from the neck up. Look, the purpose of law is supposed to distinguish proper behavior from improper behavior. We have a law against murder, which is justified, which means murderers go to jail and guys that don't murder don't go to jail. Rapists go to jail and non-rapists don't. But look, if you can be guilty of a crime for charging either higher, lower, or the same prices as everyone else, and you got to do one of the three, you know, what kind of a law is that?
Yeah, it basically leaves us all open to regulation just if they feel like it, really, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah, it's just sort of a carte blanche to put anyone in jail that you don't like. So the whole thing is sort of dead from the neck up.
All right, everybody. We're talking with Walter Block from the Ludwig von Mises Institute for Austrian Economics, and we'll be right back to talk about gold. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Walter Block. He's a professor and chair of economics at Loyola University in New Orleans, and he writes for my precious LouRockwell.com, Mises.org, and 100 other libertarian and Austrian economic publications. And before we get quite to gold there, Mr. Block, on the antitrust, you made a good case that, you know, you can't charge too much, can't charge too little, you can't charge the same. They'll find a way to prosecute you if they want to. Antitrust law can basically just be used to punish the enemies of those who are politically connected, that kind of thing. However, I'm not sure if you address, which I probably didn't ask it directly, but what are we in a free market supposed to do with, say Standard Oil? John Rockefeller buys up all the oil in the place, and nobody can ever compete with him again.
Well, before we get to Standard Oil, let me just talk for a second about Microsoft, but I will get to Standard Oil.
Sure.
The reason most people think that first of all, the government was getting on IBM long before Microsoft, and they, at that time, IBM was the only computer company. But the point is that it wasn't a monopoly, because what a monopoly means is that it's illegal to compete with IBM. See, in the old days, the king would give the duke a monopoly of cannels or salt or something because he fought the good battle against the French or something. But the word monopoly means it shall be illegal to compete against. What's been done is it's been perverted into thinking that just because this one producer, he can have his way with us. So when IBM was the only one, the antitrust people got on their case because they would be profiteering and exploiting people. But the point is that if there are really profits to be made hand over fist in the field, there'll be other entrants who will take advantage of it.
Which is exactly what happened. Michael Dell and Compaq and Gateway and everybody else came in and started making their own PCs.
And then the reason they got Bill Gates is because Bill Gates wasn't paying off the Democrat and the Republican parties. Now they set up this foundation and all, and Bill Gates is giving out money all over the place, and I'm sure they'll be free. But the antitrust works to punish enemies. You know, the Democrats get Republican companies, and the Republicans get Democrat companies. The whole thing is just silly. Okay, now to get to Standard Oil. The usual case with Standard Oil is that it's sort of predatory price cutting. What Standard Oil does is it lowers its price in Texas, and it gets rid of the independent guy in Texas, and then it lowers, and then it jacks up the price to the sky in Texas, and it goes off to California and knocks out the independent oil producer there and then jacks up the prices. But this is really very silly, because let's suppose that the oil refinery, whatever it is, a barrel of oil in 1910, that was the Standard Oil case, and I think it was 1911. Let's suppose that the cost was $5, and both Standard Oil and the independent oil refiner, their cost was $5. And all of a sudden, Standard Oil lowers its price to $2 and supposedly drives out the independent. But the independent can say, take out an advertisement and say, look, Standard Oil is going to lower its price from 5 to 2. We're shutting down. We're just going to have a skeleton crew to make sure that our operation doesn't rust. And we invite all of our customers to go to Standard Oil and buy their oil at $2 a gallon. And by the way, we'll be elbowing you to get that oil. And as soon as Standard Oil comes to their senses and raise their prices to a normal level, then we'll go back into business. So the whole thing is sort of stupid, and the independent could, go to the other independents all around the country and say, hey, look, this is what Standard Oil is trying to do. Help us out if there's a war. Another point is that before Standard Oil started this ploy, it had, say, 50% of the Texas market, and the independent had 50%. But after the other guy shuts down, it's going to have 100% of the market. It's going to be losing $3 on every barrel. It's going to go broke. So the whole thing is sort of stupid. And there is a very important journal article written by John McGee in the Journal of Law and Economics in 1960, which goes over the Standard Oil case and says that the real reason for the Rockefeller, not monopoly, because it was never illegal to compete, but the real reason that Rockefeller did so well is that he rationalized the industry. He had all sorts of innovations, and he depended upon economies of scale and efficiency. So John D. Rockefeller was the Bill Gates of his day. And the people who were ignorant of economics, economic illiterates, blamed him for, whatever. And John McGee shows that under Rockefeller, the prices of oil kept falling, as under Bill Gates and under IBM, the prices of a given computer thing kept falling. So what kind of a monopoly is it? Also with, the Alcoa Aluminum, they had an antitrust case against them, and the price of bauxite and aluminum keep falling, and TVs prices keep falling, and yet the antitrust people are on their case. Look, if antitrust is intellectually incoherent, because what they're really saying is that you need lots of competitors, and if you have just one or a big firm, they'll take advantage. Well, if that was so, then the antitrust ought to be broken up. They ought to have 10,000 little antitrusts and not one big one, because they're a monopoly on their own grounds.
Right, yeah. Don't ever call the state a monopoly. They're a
different
category, right.
Precisely, exactly. So the whole thing is dead from the neck up, and it's just something that economic illiterates like your teacher in junior high pull on unsuspecting kids.
Well, and we also see the effect of what happened when they finally did break the Standard Oil Trust. He just went and bought a lobbying firm, and the Rockefellers have owned the government ever since.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more that a lot of these regulatory agencies get captured by the people that they're supposedly regulating, and a lot of times business are the ones that ask for the thing in the first place. For example, in the case of the Meat Inspection Act, the reason we had them is not because the government was protecting consumers against the avaricious meat inspectors, it's meat companies, meat packers, it's rather that the large meat packers in the 1890s, Swift and all, Moore in Chicago, were losing market share to little guys. So they came up with this wonderful ploy to get a Food and Drug Administration and the Meat Inspection Act going, and it would be manned by their own employees, and there would be economies of scale and filling out regulations and paperwork and stuff. And after that, these guys started getting their market share back. So the whole thing was just a scheme.
There are those who have made the argument that the entire regulatory state, the whole progressive era, was a scheme. That really,
absolutely.
It was all a matter of, oh, please don't throw me in the briar patch. Last thing I want is a giant federal government.
Right, right. No, I couldn't agree with you more. Indeed, the market is a much better way of regulating food and drugs than is the FDA. The FDA screwed up with thalidomide. They supported it, and then you had birth defects. And now what the FDA did, they've been burned by that, is they refused to approve of drugs. And there are drugs that could save lives, and it costs millions, billions of dollars to get a drug approved by those people, and it takes 10, 15 years. Meanwhile, people are dying for lack of those drugs. At the very least, a very moderate change would be that instead of giving the FDA the power to prohibit stuff, they just make a recommendation, and then people are free to do with drugs as they wish.
You know, if you were to really be an extremist anti-government maniac, you could even say that they're responsible for killing people if they're withholding.
Absolutely. Yeah, I am an extremist maniac because I think the FDA is responsible for killing people, and I think the fact that the highways are not privatized is responsible for some 40,000 deaths a year on the highways, which is way more than, say, the number of soldiers that died, let alone Iraq, but just the Vietnam, where there were 50,000 U.S. soldiers who died in all of the years that we were in Vietnam, and there were 40,000 people every year who die on the nation's highways. And this is due to highway socialism or road socialism.
You think so?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, this is the hardest one to get by people, privatizing the roads. Wouldn't you just have guys with guns manning roadblocks and charging an arm and a leg everywhere?
Well, you know, in the early days of roads, and remember, we got to get to gold.
We got to get to gold. Yeah, you brought up the roads. It's your fault.
Okay, my fault, mea culpa. There's just so many things to talk about. It's horrible to have to stick to 1 hour.
But right, let's just do the roads quick, and then we'll do gold.
Okay. The early roads were all private roads. And yes, you had guys with guns at toll booths, and, you know, they would collect money, and they would build roads, and they would charge based on the number of horses and how heavy the wagon was, and the width of the wheel. Like, if the wheel was very thin, like an ice skate, they would charge a lot because the wheel would rip up the road, and if the wheel were wide, think steamroller, steam whatever, then it would keep the road together, and they would charge a little less, and it was a viable economic concern, and then the government nationalized it. And since then, we've been reaping the whirlwind with all these needless deaths. Now, they blame it on fast driving and drunken driving and this and that and the other, but the real reason is the fact that the managers of the road, namely the government, can't manage their way out of a paper bag. A private company would be better able to deal with this, and if they weren't, they'd go broke. Whereas when the government fails, there's no automatic profit and loss incentive to get a better a manager. I mean, the reason that restaurants and hotels and hula hoops and stuff are reasonably good, and pizza, is because if you get a bad pizza, they go broke. That doesn't happen. You don't have this market test of survivorship for government.
Was it you that wrote the article about the roads in San Francisco trying to catch your plane in the rain?
Well, I am coming out with a new book with Mellon Press on privatizing the highways, and it consists of many, many articles that I've written, and I don't remember that I wrote about roads in San Francisco, but I've written about roads pretty much everywhere else.
All right, well, everybody Google roads and Walter Block and read all about that. But we got to skip to gold because you want to talk about gold.
Absolutely.
Tell me about gold.
We must talk about gold. Gold, gold, gold. Here is a case where, again, the Austrian and the Chicagoite free enterprise schools are distinguished. Remember, in antitrust, the Austrians say get rid of the whole thing root and branch. The Chicagoites say keep it and, you know, rationalize it. Well, it's the same with money. It's only the Austrians who favor a gold standard, whereas the Chicagoites, like Milton Friedman, favor the fiat currency Fed, which creates inflation and on his own ground started the Depression. If you look at the depressions and inflations and business cycles for the 100 years before and after 1913 when the Fed came in, before the Fed it was more of a gold standard and afterward no gold standard or much, much less, you'll see that gold is associated with much more stability than is the fiat currency. And the reason for it is, look, if you had a printing press in your basement, would you be churning it and printing up $1,000 bills?
Yes.
You're darn tootin'. Well, for the government, there are three ways to raise money. One is taxes, and everyone who's doing that. And the other is borrowing, and everyone who's doing that. And the third is inflation. And then not everyone realizes that the printing press is responsible for the inflation, and they can blame the greed of businessmen or workers or consumers or something like that.
And it really is a hidden taxation, right? They're basically stealing the value out of your dollar without actually taking the dollar.
Absolutely. Whereas with gold, you just can't add zeros. And you know what I'm saying?
You want to tie the value of the money to a piece of gold so that they can't just go and manipulate the numbers around.
Precisely, exactly.
Now, do you want to tie gold to money with the law or just by pressures of the market?
Oh, no, by law, because if you add more dollars to the gold backing, it's fraud. In other words, if a dollar is backed by, say, a half ounce of gold or something like that, and you start reducing the backing, that's fraud, and you should go to jail along with bad check writers. And in that way, the only time you would have more money is when they discover more gold. And that is sort of an exogenous thing. Whereas with the printing press, governments just go berserk. You know, they're sort of like drunkards.
Now, let me ask you to differentiate there, because you say there wouldn't be any more money until there's more gold. But would that prohibit the creation of new wealth?
No, it wouldn't prohibit the creation of new wealth, just new money. Money is not the same as wealth. See, gold is, or money is really the lifeblood of the economy, and except for barter, money is one half of every transaction, buying, selling, renting, what have you. So it's very important that the gold or the money, be stable, or at least not, go all over the lot as it does with government fiat currency. So forget about a dollar. Just suppose that we traded gold ounces or tenths of gold ounces, or you want to buy a car, you know, you have to pay 20 gold ounces or something. Well, now government would be helpless or unable to just, you know, add 2 or 5 or 10% to the money supply at its whim. It would be handcuffed, or at least one of its sources of great power would be taken from it. And I'm all for reducing the power of government, because I see government as mainly a very negative institution.
Got a couple of minutes before the last break, and then we only got 5 more after that, and I got many different directions I could take this interview from here. I'm going to ask you to tell me about Murray Rothbard.
Well, that's a delight. I was fortunate enough to know Murray Rothbard, even to be a friend of his. I regard him as the Mr. Libertarian. He unfortunately died in 1995. I think it was age 68. I had wished he'd live as long as Bezos, who lived almost who lived into his 90s. Murray Rothbard was what do they say in football, a triple threat? Well, he's probably a quintuple threat. He was an eminent economist, an eminent philosopher, an eminent ethicist, an eminent historian, a libertarian theorist, economist, the Austrian economist. he was sort of, I wouldn't say a one-man band, because he had many followers, such as myself, and indeed the entire Mises Institute is can be considered a follower of his. He was Mr. Libertarian. He tried to show through many of his, all of his writings, that markets are ethical and productive and efficacious, and governments are the very opposite.
Where might one read great writings by Rothbard or you or others about Austrian economic theory and libertarian thought?
The Mises Web, I think, is a source of certainly my writings, Murray Rothbard's writings, Hayek, Mises, Menger. Just look up Mises, M-I-S-E-S.com, and you will be able to access Murray Rothbard's great writings like Man, Economy, and State, and For a New Liberty, and The Ethics of Liberty. Much of this is available electronically. You can buy the books, too, at a very low price, but it's available for free. One of Murray's best books, to say start for beginner, is What Has Government Done to Our Money?, which is a support of the gold standard, vis-a-vis government fiat currency. So Murray Rothbard is my mentor, my hero, my model. Count me as a big fan of his.
Now, his magnum opus, the big, most important one, is Man, Economy, and State, right?
Correct.
And you can read that whole book online at Mises.org.
Absolutely. And not only can you read it online, but you could search. I mean, you know, lots of times you read a 700-page book and you remember, aha, I got to look something up, and then you saw flipping pages.
Ah, yes.
Well, now you could just put the word up and search for it, and you'll find the 10 or the 20 times you used the word, and you'll be able to access what you're looking for. And you'll be able to cut and paste the stuff if you want to cite it.
That's at Mises.org. We'll be right back.
True. Gold and silver have been a source of true wealth for years. In fact, people around the world have used these metals to buy and sell goods for over 5,000 years. And gold and silver will continue to be a source of true wealth for the foreseeable future. If you look back in history, you'll see that all fiat currencies have failed to maintain wealth or failed altogether. But gold has always protected its holder, a true asset, usable to anyone around the globe. As the value of your Federal Reserve note continues to depreciate, gold will be your only insurance. As an example, in 1975, you could buy a $40,000 home with 1,000 gold coins. Today, that same house is $400,000, yet you can still buy it with 1,000 gold coins. To find out more information on how to protect your wealth, call Republic Trading at 1-800-691-7898. That's 1-800-691-7898.
Hey, everybody, I'm Scott Horton. This is my weekend interview show, and I'm talking with Walter Block. He's the chair of economics at Loyola University, and he writes for Mises.org and a million other libertarian journals and websites and places like that. Search around for Walter Block in your Google search engine. And I think I want to spend this last 5 minutes talking about private property anarchy.
Could I just take 30 seconds more on gold?
Do what you like.
The people who wrote that ad copy for the ad are brilliant. What they said, I forget the exact data, but it was in 1950 you could buy a house for $100,000 for 1,000 gold pieces. Now the house will cost $500,000, but it's still 1,000 gold pieces. The point is that there's been no inflation in the form of gold, whereas the dollar has lost all of its value.
Yep.
Just brilliant. Milton Friedman thinks that we're gold fetishists, but we're not. You see, there's nothing particular about gold or silver. Rather, it's that whenever people were free to choose, they chose gold. So gold won out the competition of monies. I mean, it beat out fish hooks and tobacco and stuff for various complicated reasons. But the reason we favor gold is because gold is chosen by people when they were free to choose. Milton Friedman wrote a book, Free to Choose, but he doesn't act consistently with it.
Right. It was the state that came and took that freedom away.
Absolutely. So Friedman is a socialist on money.
Right, so. All right,
okay.
So now, private property anarchy. When people hear the word anarchy, they think of scary brown men with weapons and arson fires and chaos and vigilantes and being scared. And yet, when I read what you write, you seem to think that anarchy means peace and prosperity.
Absolutely, yes. You see, the brilliance behind the free market anarchist, and I distinguish us from the left-wing anarchists who are just crazy. They're against money, they're against property, they're against profits.
They're just communists. Is
right, commie anarchists. But we have a very different view. Our view is the market is the best civilizing device known to man. The market is why we have relatively good cars and shoes and wristwatches. And the reason for it is the profit and loss test. Those people that satisfy customers expand their base of operations and make profits, and those that can't cut the mustard have to go into other operations. So this works for ships and sealing wax and candles and cars and everything else under the sun. Why, too, couldn't it work for protection? I mean, we can see that the government police are very inefficient because, look, suppose a policeman does a great job. Does he automatically get more money? No. Suppose he does a lousy job. Does he automatically get fired as a grocer would get fired for doing a bad job? No. Whereas if we had market agencies protecting ourselves, we would be doing much better. Like, take guns. I mean, guns are the great equalizer. You can't always get a cop to protect you, and you can't sue cops if somebody mugs you and they're not there to protect you. And what do? They trash the Second Amendment. Whereas a private police agency would probably charge you less if you had a gun than if you didn't have a gun, just as a private fire protection insurance company will charge you less if you put in sprinklers.
Well, but what about the poor and the weak? Who's going to protect them?
Well, the poor and the weak aren't being very well protected by government. I think that where are you safer, in Disney World or in the public park, say Central Park in New York City?
Right. There you go.
In Central Park, you get raped. Does anyone lose money? No. If you get raped in Disney World, the whole thing is impossible. They've got cameras because their very existence depends upon your safety, whereas the existence of the mayor of New York doesn't depend upon the safety in Central Park.
Oh, man, I wish I had another hour to continue this interview. Thank you so much for your time today, Mr. Block.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Everybody, Walter Block. He writes for LouRockwell.com and Mises.org, among many other places. So check him out. We'll be right back.